Welcome to the RSP cast. I'm Matt Walden with the Rookie Scouting Portfolio. Today is what I would call a selfish episode. And I think that selfish episodes are good episodes within reason. And why that is, I think, is that if I selfishly want to learn about something, I'm hoping and counting on that many of you feel the same way. And today's guest is going to fulfill that selfishness that I have here in the sense that today I'm going to introduce Andy Ryland. Andy Ryland works at USA Football. He is a former outside linebacker at Penn State and a rugby All-American. And he is very much a specialist in education and skills acquisition areas in terms of coaching, and works with a number of coaches. And he's a movement specialist. And he's he mentioned to me just a minute ago that's near and dear to his heart is tackling. And I thought a great podcast would be for him to discuss tackling I'll get into it in a minute. Andy, thank you so much and welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be on. As I said, I don't often need much encouragement to talk about the tackle or tackle training. It's kind of where I've cut my teeth over the past 2 or 3 years, really transitioning kind of to a specialty area. So I'm thrilled to talk about this. I love the work. I read the stuff. We go back and forth on social, so to sit down and get a chance to chat is great.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate that. And, what really caught my eye was getting the chance to listen to you on Matt Caraccio's Saturday to Sunday podcast with the Skills Acquisition Series, and you mentioned KPIs. And as someone who worked, I got into what I do through an industry of doing quality management work and operations management work, and KPIs were a part of what I had to learn as a manager and how to develop processes and work through that. And I ended up using that a lot as a basis for how I developed my own evaluation of football performance with specific positions. So when you mentioned that, I thought, I definitely need to learn more about what Andy does and follow what he does. And as someone who wants to learn more about the defensive side of the ball and definitely learn about tackling, is, the fact that you mentioned you had, I believe, if I remember, tell me if I'm wrong, it was something like 29 KPIs on tackling, key process indicators on how you would, what you're looking for when you're looking at defenders and how they tackle.
Yeah, so I think we actually have 33, so we were okay. Pretty close. And it's one of those things that, again, to put it in fair perspective, you might not start out with that, or, if I were advising or working with a coach, I probably wouldn't start with that full list. Having done this a while now, that you just kind of come to you you have kind of the coach's eye, you're trained to see what you're looking for, but there's 33 KPIs that we look at. And the way I, explain it to people is that, within skill training, skill acquisition, motor control, all those things, we have this idea that the human body is different and there's bandwidth and everything's going to be a little bit different. But when you get on the field and you watch most coaches, it's being coached in millimeters, where the hand goes, where the feet goes, where these things go. And so I was trying to reconcile these two facts, and the KPI system just kind of seemed to work well for me. And then working with some of my mentors, some unbelievable world-renowned coaches, they weren't calling them KPIs, but they were using a very similar system. The scientific fancy way, and I think I wrote this in a blog recently, is, through our study of biomechanics, through our study of sports history, through our evaluation of our own teams, there's certain things that we start to associate with positive outcomes. We completed the pass, we made the block, we made the tackle. And oftentimes we start realizing that some of those things aren't what coaches have actually been teaching, or they have a much bigger bandwidth than the millimeters that we talk about. Here's your aim point and your strike point for an offensive line block. then you watch some really successful blockers and they complete the block without hitting those marks.
Right.
Okay, well, what happened here? Well, he was able to refit his hands. He was able to work his hips. And, you know, he's a bigger guy. He has, you know, so his hands actually worked really well when it was slightly outside. And he was able to use that to torque. Well, which one is right? And if the goal is to complete the task, then I think we start looking at, okay, how do we do it? What's the bandwidth? But there are some principles we know are going to, you know, in turn, have you not be quite as successful. So if, you know, we do a bad job creating torque as a quarterback, if I lose the hip height battle in any of my collision aspects, there's a much greater chance for a negative outcome. So let's start looking at what are some things that we think are really highly correlated to successful outcomes in the tackle. And you start writing them down. And then as we initially started grading, one of the really interesting things is that sometimes they became the reason for a missed tackle, and sometimes they became the reason for the tackle. So you don't always have to hit all 33, and I would never expect an athlete to be running out on the field thinking I got to hit these 33, you know, perfect points. But as you start grading, you start to see, okay, that, you know, he didn't do this well, he didn't do this well, but you know what? He did this amazing, and he was able to complete the play. Now, we can further evaluate and say, you know, if I hit those first two KPIs, maybe I could have had a more dominant tackle. Maybe I could have made the tackle a yard or two sooner. But it becomes both a correction and also kind of an appreciation point for when we're working with the athletes on what did they do really well, what did they struggle with, and how can we start to really, what I'm passionate about is start creating those plans to help correct some of those issues. And, you know, if you're a position coach, there's a good chance not everybody in your linebacker group has the same challenges. And yet we'll go to individual drill and we're going to go, okay, we're going to do angle tackle today. And we're going to line up our cones and our bag and the guys are going to go through the motions. And you've all seen high level individual drills. It's really not any skill development. It's pretty much a glorified warm up, getting ready for team. But you go, these guys all have holes. We just saw it on film and we're not addressing it. So the more detailed we can be with that KPI system or whatever our grading system is, then we can start to say, hey, athlete A, I need you to work on X, Y, and Z. And hey, on all three of your misses, I noticed this happen. Like, let's see if we can clear this up. So it tells you strengths. It tells you weaknesses. It allows you to paint a picture of each player, each position group. We've seen some really interesting trends within different defenses or different coverages based on what types of tackles have being made. You know, we, at least for me, I look at, you know, we have three different strike levels on the tackle. So strike heights, you look at, you have front, side on, angle, and behind. So four different sides of that. And I qualify finishes. So you start talking about all the different finishes. Was it a drive finish, a roll finish, a grapple finish, a hook and handle finish? You start looking at, wow, there's a lot more depth to these tackle things. And our guys have different strengths and weaknesses. If I want to create the best player, I probably need to be tracking some of this.
Now, this was great, because one of the things that you just mentioned here, I mean, there's a few things that I want to unpack a little bit more. I mean, I think to begin with, when you talk about the measuring in millimeters, I mean, I've kind of joked in a very layman's term that it comes down to really kind of the joking, like Larry the Cable Guy kind of comedy, where he says the phrase "get her done." Sometimes it's about that result. Are you able to, you know, is it technically sound? Maybe not. Or is it more that the technique is different than what's prescribed? And I think that's really what more that is the technique different than what's prescribed? And is it something that's being used in the correct situation? Because overall, football is a performance craft and it's not a science. And I think that that's where, you know, when you see the relationship between performance, I had a musician on recently on this show, and we talked about how there's a lot of parallels between football and improvisational music, because there are, there are foundational elements, there are techniques, and then there are, you know, and then, and you have those skills with that, and then how you process all of that information together and how you come pick and choose what you're going to do with it. And I think that when it comes to evaluation, especially if you're trying to scout or evaluate players, it's very easy to fall into a trap when you're trying to create a system of grading players that you can get so rigid in what you're looking at that you're, and I think it probably happens with coaches as well, based on just some conversations with some players, is that you can get so rigid in how you're looking at it that you're missing out on what's special about that player and how to maximize those players' skills, knowing that they may always have or may have some weaknesses that can be shored up, and but they may also have some strengths that are so overwhelming that the weak areas there aren't something that you want to totally ding against them on a level where you're going to basically overlook that player and not value that player appropriately.
No, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. I'm a, you know, situational dependency is key. The game provides context, and our athletes have to try to work within those to solve the, you know, the movement problem, as they say. It's funny, I'm a tackle guy, but I think the easiest example that I always try to paint for coaches is, an offensive tackle in pass protection, because he looks pretty isolated. Well, we drill this punch and we have this technical model and we know what it should look like, but then all of a sudden you start thinking about, okay, well, if the rusher rushes wide, if he rushes off my shoulder, if he rushes down the middle and tries to bowl, or if he rushes inside, that's going to change my strike angle. And if he presents me his chest, or if he presents me his shoulder pad, or if he turns sideways and tries to long arm me, I'm going to have a different strike target. And if he's fast off the ball, or he's slow off the ball, or he's a really fast guy who got a bad jump, or he's a slow guy who saved up something special for third down, now he's coming at me at different speeds, and I might be taking a jump set, a 45, or a vertical, depending on the play call. So all of a sudden you realize that each and every one of those strikes is so independent and unique, and none of them will probably look like the textbook example. But there's a reason for that. None of them should look like that, yeah, because the situation for that textbook strike was not presented. What was presented was a guy hunched over at the waist, coming off the ball overly fast, trying to get outside and giving me only his inside shoulder pad as a target. Well, what's that punch going to look like? It's not going to be what we drilled, you know, walking down the wall, punching our ladders and doing that kind of stuff. But if I'm what I have started to tell coaches, and I don't know if I'm right or wrong, but it works for me, is that, you know, we're not actually looking for the robotic repetition of it. We're actually looking for the most amount of variability we can get with, yes, with a positive outcome. So I want to be able to throw that pass protection strike to a variety of targets at a variety of speeds from a variety of angles. I need this huge movement variability in that strike. The measurement should be, can I hit the appropriate target? And again, to your point, sometimes that target and our choice of target will be different because, hey, this guy's really hunched over. I might try to cave him in on himself. Maybe I'm going to try to strike from underneath and lift him. Maybe I'm going to try to lock him out early because he's giving me some chest. So all that interplay leads to, you know, was that the best choice for the situation? When I'm doing tackling, I say if I pause the film at any place and then try to look at it objectively and say, did they make the right decision for this situation? So maybe his feet were mixed up. Maybe he was engaged in a block. Maybe he was out leveraged. So for this situation, did he use the appropriate tools? Then that's probably the best case scenario. Now we can go back and look at how he got in the bad position, but it's so independent and so environmentally opponent related as well that I think if you're not taking into account those things, you may just be like, well, this guy's pass protection technique is unstable. It looks different every time. Well, maybe it should have if we open up the expanded view of it.
Yeah, and it's funny. I mean, it goes back to something I've heard from a friend of mine, Ryan Riddle, who was a defensive end at Cal during the Tedford, Aaron Rodgers, Marshawn Lynch era of time, during that time. And he was their sack leader. I think he still holds their single season sack record. But he was telling me about how, you know, when he first got there, that the coach that he had was a guy who, you know, he was learning his craft as a coach. And Ryan had kind of some unconventional, or at least labeled that way, unconventional ways of doing certain things. And he said that there was a lot of conversation back and forth between he and his coach about, you know, hey, you know, that I'm doing these things and they're working, they work in practice, I'm getting the result, I'm, you know, this is why I'm doing this. And at first the coach was like, well, you know, it's not what we're teaching in terms of this, and this. And it kind of got to a point where the coach finally said, okay, I trust you to do this because it's getting the result. As long as it's still getting the result, I'm okay with this. But, you know, the coach at that time also had come over from the positions he had learned. This was a new position that he was coaching, was defensive line. So, you know, it kind of speaks to what you're saying about, you know, how you describe how that works in detail. What I'd like to do is kind of how we've established the fact that, you know, despite having, you know, 33 KPIs, the way that you look at it philosophically is different than this, you know, very prescriptive look at things. I'd still like to kind of go back and look at some of the basics and have you describe to someone like myself who, you know, when it comes to tackling what I know is maybe slightly a little more than what Chris Spielman talks about on his you know, national broadcast of football games on a weekly basis. If you could kind of start back and really talk about kind of the fundamentals of tackling, of what you're looking for, and then maybe specific techniques. And you know, you already classified a few from in terms of angles and then in terms of how you take the finishes. But I would love for you to go into that in more detail.
Yeah, 100%. So I break the tackle up into kind of five areas, you know, that are generally going to be chronological. So we look at tracking. We look at our preparation, which is going to be, you know, our body position going into contact, our connection with the ball carrier. Obviously, we have the acceleration, and then our finish. You know, we'll have different types of finishes to get the guy on the ground, which is the ultimate goal. And then within those, we start to break up some of the different KPIs. And one that, at least in my conversations, people have always found is interesting is that one of the first things that I look at is the communication. That's a huge KPI for me because the tackle begins the moment the huddle is broken, in my terminology. You know, that if we are not exchanging information on the deployment of the offense, any checks we have, whether it's coverage, whether it's front, making sure that we are aligned in our responsibility, we're already putting ourselves behind the eight ball. So if we're playing a zone read team or a team that has zone read tendencies, every formation, there's probably going to be some communication between a linebacker and a defensive end on, are we spilling and scraping? Are we squeezing? You know, who has to dive? Who has to quarterback? So that communication has to start instantaneously because I may be putting myself out of position to make a tackle. Because, you know, you see it all the time on film. There's multiple guys in the same gap. So that could have been a failure within reading the play, but it could also be a communication failure. So I start even, you know, that early. And that's always an interesting KPI to talk about. Did we know our responsibility? Did we know our role? Were we identifying the threats that are most common, most challenging, and seeing the opponent? You know, another one that I'll give you is our angle approach and leverage. And I think leverage, thanks to our good friends at the Seahawks, and I was lucky enough to develop a great relationship with Coach Seto, you know, became a really big term within the tackle community. But within leverage, we also have to look at our angle and our approach. So I've written a bit about the angle and approach within the tackle that, you know, not just getting to that spot. And we'll say, you know, everyone's tracking near hip now. Well, I can get to the near hip, but the orientation of my body, whether or not I'm square to the near hip, I'm a 45 degree angle to the near hip, that's going to dictate the amount of force I can put into the ball carrier's front side. That's just some basic physics. So if we're shoulder to shoulder, our hips are parallel as I reach that near hip, I'm going to be able to get a large portion of my shoulder on the front side of the body and really look for that great knockback positive grade tackle. If I'm coming in offset at a 45 degree angle, I could get to the same spot on the field, but my orientation is going to mean that the force I'm able to deliver through the ball carrier is going to be on a much different angle. Now I'm looking to maybe drive him back on a 45 degree angle instead of straight back. So those, some of those little things that go more than just leverage outside in or inside out, but what's our body position at that moment? What's our orientation? What did our approach path look like is going to, to me, determine ultimately what is the best tackle type to use in that situation. And I guess we'll touch on some of the tackle types a little bit later. But yeah, that's how. So those are some of the things that we look at. And then some of the things can be physical in nature, but because of the dynamicism of the play, you know, something like a change of direction or a speed challenge can be interesting, because as a evaluator, you have to start to look at, well, was it a limitation in speed or change of direction? Or was it a response issue? You know, did they not make the read? Did they not see something clearly? Did they not react in a timely manner? So that could be an information processing issue of not seeing the cutback or not seeing the foot in the ground. And then by time I change directions, it looks like, oh man, that dude got stepped. He got cut back on so hard. But was it my ability to put my foot in the ground, absorb force, redirect force and change direction? Or was it a mental processing issue that put me a step behind? So that kind of goes into the vision, speed, change of direction, and kind of how some of that decision making all goes into that tracking aspect of simply just getting to the ball carrier. And then I think I tweeted this the other day, but at the NFL level, you have to remember they're paying guys $10 million to not let you make the tackle. So it's not going to be a free run. Your angle and your path to the ball carrier is going to get interrupted and disrupted a little bit. And so, you know, we have to deal with that issue in our sport as opposed to some of the other collision tackle sports.
Yeah, and a good example of that in, I would think, even too, also maybe what your responsibility is and how that responsibility, you know, how much responsibility you're given. I mean, I think I saw a play this weekend where Todd Gurley ran in for a touchdown on a play where it looked like Patrick Peterson had to keep that play inside at first and try, and at least he had to manage that inside area. And then Gurley bounced outside and was able to beat his angle to the edge for the score. And I would think that there are some plays too, where maybe the defender has kind of like, I have to play inside first and then chase on the outside, as opposed to playing the outside and funneling him inside. Cause he had like two plays like that, where one, he had to kind of handle the outside and force him inside. But then the first play was one where it looked like his responsibility was to try and prevent Gurley from cutting back inside, and Gurley was able to bounce it outside and just happened to be faster on that angle, unless Peterson was playing outside completely from the get-go.
I think I know the play you're talking about, because it almost looked like Peterson took a bit of a banana line where he kind of rounded the inside and then tried to push him back out. And those are the decisions that, I think become very variable on the field, but I'm playing within the framework of my defense. And in doing that, did I put myself in a disadvantageous situation? And that's, you know, the old get the coach going, what are you doing? What are you doing? Attaboy. And,
exactly.
As our coach, my linebacker coach, used to always tell us, if you take it, you better make it. So if you're going to deviate, you better make that play, or else we're going to have a conversation. And Patrick Peterson may have been caught between two minds. I can't speak for him. But, you know, to avoid the conversation of not getting beat inside, he took that hard banana angle and was obviously going against an incredibly talented running back. So yeah, how we approach and deal with those things, especially within the schematics of football. And like I said, you may have Zach Martin chasing you after you. Like, okay, well, what's the best decision there? So it's not an easy thing at all.
No, definitely not. And I mean, what else would you touch upon about just from the beginning in terms of tracking?
Yeah, so you know, tracking is very interesting skill to me because, you know, when we watch a lot of football, we seem to see a lot of tracking errors, right? A lot of bad angles or things like that. And tracking is probably the very first game we all play as children. You know, my kids are 4 and 2, and my son's favorite game is chase. Like, I don't really know what the goal of it is, but he loves just to run around the house and and we chase each other. And so, and I watch the kids at the park and in the backyard, and these simple games of chase are probably the first games we play, and it's a form of tracking. So I personally believe, and I have no evidence to this, but the context and responsibilities within the defense start to put some limits on how we're supposed to effectively track. And while we need to work together with our teammates, and I'm not saying we should have no support and no force and no contained players, but I think sometimes those challenges make it more difficult because we have to, you know, solve task one, check off task two, you know, okay, task three is not there. Oh, now I got to run. And it can sometimes become a little bit more difficult than that. But the other thing is, you know, we can get into kind of the free play and all those different things. And our athletes actually being tested or trained in a manner that overloads the skill set of tracking and getting there with the, you know, for completing the task. And I don't know, I haven't been around enough programs, but I know with the teams we do work with, we try to institute some really intense, what I call overload training, where we're actually stressing, you know, the visual system, where the decision-making system, and then the ability to take the right angle. So in some of our drills, you know, it's not uncommon for us to have a box or, you know, your normal setup where we're tracking multiple players. We're using players as distractors who aren't actually the carrier. So we'll have drills where we're a player, no one has the ball, so you can't see who the runner is. And we have to react based on movement, who's trying to score, who's threatening our area of responsibility, and just trying to challenge those things. Because I think if we can make those decisions and read the plays quicker, then we can get ourselves into the tracking phase normally a little bit quicker. So it's about having really disciplined eyes. It's about making fast, quick decisions, being great information processors. And then, of course, we have to take the right angles, the right approaches. Those are probably simpler to train. Where I think happens is that players do their little, you know, simple run to the cone, shuffle alley press, run and gather drills. But if they're not doing that drill coming out of a complex decision-making process, like trying to read and diagnose a play, then they're not fully prepared for the game day environment.
Yeah, I think that's so critical. I mean, I watch this all the time, and I remember the first time I'd go to some of these all-star game practices, and I remember just, you know, from the other side of the ball, watching pass protection drills for running backs. And I just, you know, personally, I'm sitting there going, I'm not getting a ton of value out of this as an evaluator from my perspective, because I'm sitting here watching this and going, he's not diagnosing whether, you know, what type of work he's got to do with the offensive lineman and pick up a responsibility in terms of diagnosing pre-snap what's going on. And he's certainly not in a situation where he's handling a defensive lineman, or he's in a crowded area and he has to choose between whether he should be doing a stand-up block or a cut block. And those are things that a drill just kind of teaches to the test. It's kind of like an accounting program that basically teaches a class on how to pass an accounting exam to get certified in your in your area, but you're not dealing with real world problems that actually your business is going to be dealing with. And I think that those types of parallels exist when we watch some of these programs. So when I see people and I look at, you know, I look at media reports about, you know, how a player performed in drills, some of the drills I'm looking at, I'm going, you know, it didn't make any sense to me to like comment on the drill, because it's like, well, he punched well in that situation. He got, you know, he got square. That's good. But I'm not going to say he's a good pass protector because he did this drill really well. So,
yeah, to me, it's the separation of technique versus skill. And we can check someone's technique sometimes in those overly prescriptive drills, but the ability to apply it dynamically, which is what I classify as skill, is much more difficult. And the question that I think all coaches or scouts or anyone can always ask themselves is, what makes it difficult on game day? Yeah. You know, and I always try to ask that question when we're designing drills or designing things. If what makes tracking difficult in game day is I have to clear my initial responsibility, I may have to defeat a block, I may need to diagnose the play, and then I enter the tracking phase. Well, the simple, you know, follow your buddy down the field drill isn't preparing me for that situation. Or Keith Grabowski, who's one of my coworkers, gave a great example about, you know, routes versus air, which is classified as timing, but the timing is always going to be based on the collision defender. Whether that's a press man or a collision zone defender, he's going to dictate the timing because I'm going to have to navigate him. So that interplay is so crucial in our skill development series. But that's where I also think you see where I can start looking at some of the KPIs. I know square is better. I know generally a solid punch in square has been proven through our film evaluation to lead to positive outcomes. But we also have to be aware of the bandwidth and decision making that gets us to that point.
So what's the next phase after tracking? And will you share some of your, you know, some of the key processes involved with that?
Yeah, so we get into preparation after tracking. And for me, preparation is, we started this probably about 5 years ago when, you know, we initially talked about come to balance. And, you know, I think everyone, most coaches teach that in some form. And it's the idea for me that during our tracking phase, especially in today's game, you know, we're not going to be in that crouched over football position all the time. A lot of the times we're going to be high hips in sprint mechanics. And I'm trying to close this distance. I'm trying to get there. They threw the ball to that guy for a reason. He's probably really fast. And now I'm closing these great distances, but now I'm preparing for the collision. Contact is imminent. And I have to start, and I have to prepare myself for contact. So this really starts to look at our footwork, our foot placement, and our body position to be able to effectively either absorb or hopefully deliver contact. So some of the things that I'm really big on are, we talked about it earlier, but the ability to get square. So within our tracking phase, we talked about what happens when we're at different angles and how it results in a slightly different tackle. You know, which way am I going to knock the ball carrier back, and how much am I giving him to be able to drag me forward? So the ability to orient ourselves and get square towards the end of that tracking phase into preparation is something that you'll see great, you know, not a lot of yards after contact, true knockback tackle guys. They have that in abundance. It's not always, you know, pure physical qualities of their power. They position themselves well. A thing that's become huge for us lately is what we've termed dip time, which is when do we time the dip? When do we change that body position into kind of collision mode and get out of tracking? Because you'll see a lot of guys on film, they initiate the tackle very early. That was, for me, would be the dip time is just a little out of balance. It's too early. They're you know, anticipating the tackle. They're doing those things, and they just start to dip so far away that their only possible tackle becomes to almost fully elongate their body. Their toes are barely on the ground, and you start to look at those diving dry tackles where they're getting dragged instead of being able to drive through. So poor dip time leads to bad body position. It leads to our inability to keep our cleats in the ground, which is obviously going to take away our power. So looking at, you know, when we're going to dip, and that dip time is, to me, is closely related to the type of tackle we're going to make. So if I'm going to strike through your upper body, which is going to be, you know, like that a level one tackle for us, hips to numbers, I'm going to have a more vertical spine angle, which means I'm going to cover less horizontal distance. So I can initiate that dip later, and I'm going to have to close more ground with my footwork because I need to be closer to you because I'm kind of losing some of that spine length. If I'm going to make, we'll say, a thigh level tackle, now my spine is almost perpendicular to the ground. You know, I may gain some distance as far as what my strike range is, because, you know, your spine's a fixed distance, you know, vertical versus horizontal, we cover more ground. So now I can initiate the tackle sooner, and I can have my feet farther away from the ball carrier to make still make a strong positive tackle that allows me to keep my cleats in the ground. So if I look at our dip time, if I look at our foot distance on contact, and I look at our ability to stay square, those are just three of them. I think I can tell a lot about a tackler. And going back to our conversation on choices, I found myself in grading tackles saying, I think this player chose the wrong tackle type. His feet were so far away that he couldn't cover the distance, yet he chose a form tackle and tried to get into a level one strike zone. Or a really fast guy eats up the grass, closes the distance. Now we're almost, our feet are almost tangled, and he chooses to try to make a level two tackle, go into the thigh level, and now he's got this crazy rounded back because he can't elongate his body and get to his collision point with proper body position. So sometimes our footwork will determine what might be the best tackle, and sometimes guys try to force a round peg into a square hole and may choose a tackle type that doesn't actually fit their footwork or their dip timing. And I know without video examples, it may sound a little crazy, but I hope that makes sense. No,
it makes a lot of sense. And it makes me think of something right away that I think, you know, a lot of listeners on this show who are, you know, who probably are just, you know, they're doing a little bit of their own armchair analysis of just watching the game and being a fan. And oftentimes what you'll have as a common debate between just guys on a couch watching a game is, wow, that receiver made an excellent play, or that running back, you know, he did an excellent job breaking that tackle. And the other person said, well, yeah, but he didn't, but the defender didn't do this, this, and this. So when, you know, from the standpoint of, you know, for a fan, you know, how do you help them understand how to reconcile that, say, you know, a good example is, you know, Todd Gurley breaking a tackle, and you might look at it and be able to break down the tackle and say that wasn't exactly the appropriate tackle, but still be able to say, you know, how do you look at the difference between a skillful execution of an offensive player versus a defensive player's maybe failure to do something that they could have done differently? Do you necessarily always knock this kind of, does that diminish what the offensive player did? Or is it sometimes that the offensive player's ability created a problem that was a difficult one for the defender to actually make that, you know, picture perfect type of response?
Fantastic question. And, you know, I think it's one of those things that, probably because, actually, I should say guaranteed, because I'm not actively coaching my own team, I have more freedom to say these kind of things. But sometimes you got to tip your hat to the opponent. And I think it's disrespectful, right, not just to your opponent, but it's probably disrespectful to the game to not think that they are going to challenge you and put you under pressure and absolutely test the limits of your abilities. You know, otherwise they wouldn't be at this level. If you're a high school coach, you know, that's still the best kid that the other town had. That's why he's their running back. Right. At the NFL level, you know, it's fairly obvious when you see those guys. So to me, it you know, you have to respect your opponent. You have to do those things. Now, are there times when we think that a guy just absolutely flubbed a technique? 100%. The best guys in the world still flub a technique every now and then. And there's times where the offense does a great job. So, you know, I'll look at something like, so if we're looking at that situation and Todd Gurley shows some nice footwork and he's able to alter the defender's footwork, because now he's thinking, oh, he may cut back, he may juke, and then he reaccelerates and I have to dive and lunge and I can only get an arm on him and he obviously breaks my arm tackle, and you go, he really got him with that, you know, that stutter and go. The defense, you know, was playing hard on the cutback and the interactions between those two, and the defender trying to read Todd Gurley and Todd Gurley trying to read the defender, because he only accelerated when he saw the defender start to work his feet. If the defender would have kept coming at full speed, Todd may have actually hit the cutback. So we're reading each other. It's sort of an OODA loop scenario there, if you will. Now there's times where a guy is unblocked and the running back doesn't use any footwork technique and just kind of runs around the edge, and we end up in a situation where all we do is dive and get an arm out there and break the arm, and you go, I didn't really see a move and his path wasn't disrupted by a blocker. We probably just failed our tracking phase right there and took a pretty poor angle to that situation. Now, that's not to say that player, you know, I don't know where that player's eyes were, and maybe he got a poor read, or he, you know, there was some little action that took his attention away from there. So we have to be careful with that. But oftentimes, I think you have to look at what was the interplay, what led to the defender, you know, coming to balance too early, which is probably the most common one that I think I see, is, you know, that our guys will come to balance and sit down, like I said, well before dip time is needed. And now they're 3 or 4 yards away and they're starting to really hit the brakes pretty hard. And that's a lot of space for a really athletic guy. So was their footwork in time with the space that they were presented? And in those situations, you go, okay, he broke his footwork down. He took away the space. He was in a good body position, and we failed to make the tackle. Now, we could chalk one up for Todd Gurley being a super powerful athlete, or we could say, hey, in this situation, when we get this many KPIs aligned, we have to be able to make that play, because as much as I said, we want to respect our opponents, you know, you're starting linebacker on my team for a reason as well. We think you're capable of doing these things.
Makes total sense. That's a great explanation of that. So what's the next phase after preparation?
So we get into connection. So obviously that's when we're going to strike and connect with our ball carriers. And interestingly enough, the one that's on the top of my list is initial shoulder accuracy. And that's always been something that I was brought up with, just with my father as a coach and my mentors, and you know, delicate subject now, but it's interesting because with the NFL preseason rules on the collision, right, it really took shoulder accuracy to a new place, where in the past, if we had attempted to make a shoulder tackle and our technique had slipped and we had made helmet contact, it was no penalty. And now I look at it almost like hands to the face, where we're not a dirty player. We're not, you know, trying to hurt somebody, but if we are inaccurate with our technique and we try to make a shoulder tackle and now we make that helmet collision, it's going to be a penalty. And so it's kind of one of those situations where you're not a bad guy. You're probably a great human being. You weren't trying to be dirty, but you missed with your technique. I have to throw the flag. And when you put it in perspective of something like hands to the face, where you're not a bad guy, you're a pretty good human being, you tried to execute a pass rush move, you just happened to stick it into that guy's face mask, I have to call a penalty.
Yeah.
And I think part of it is understanding that. But initial shoulder accuracy for me is one of the absolute most core fundamentals. especially at the upper levels, these are the best athletes in the world. To think that we are incapable of being spatially aware enough to put our shoulder where we want it is a tough argument for me. But where it really comes into is, you know, what are we targeting on those particular plays? So am I going to strike level one, which would be hips to numbers, upper body tackle? Am I looking for that thigh level tackle? So I'm talking, you know, hips to thigh. There's going to be times where we may be in a cut tackle situation. Am I going to tackle below the knee? Is it an ankle tap? And I'm just reaching out and I have to, you know, clip his ankle with my hand. Can I be accurate in all of those situations? And then you'll see guys, you know, have a left shoulder, right shoulder accuracy discrepancy. And then we'll see what's very common for us when doing evaluations is you'll see a guy who maybe he has some flexibility or mobility issues, and he seems to be incredibly accurate in the upper body, but he becomes inaccurate striking through the thigh boards. And maybe it's, like I said, a flexibility or mobility issue that he struggles to get into those body positions, and therefore he loses a bunch of accuracy. But the multi-purpose, multifunctional tackler is going to be able to hit all of his targets from a variety of angles, from a variety of orientations on either shoulder. Again, going our three levels, one, two, three, top to bottom. We have straight on, angle, side on, and coming from behind. And if you ask most coaches, hey, when was the last time you trained a level two side on compared to a level two angle? They may look at you like you have three heads. And then you ask, well, are we preparing these guys for all of the situations that they are going to be presented with on game day?
Interesting. And it's funny because you know, so many movements in football, regardless of position, are so they're, I don't know if interrelated is the right word, but there are so many parallels, you know, with different things. And noting, yes, you know, talking about the shoulder, you know, I noticed so many parallels between defensive end and wide receiver, you know, or looking at, you know, running back and defensive end, or, you know, today I was watching Myles Garrett yesterday where he made a play, you know, and I showed that play on Twitter where I did my best to try and break it down. But, it, you know, one of the things that I noticed very clearly was, you know, how he aimed his shoulder and then also how he turned his hips to open his hips to track that guy and then be able to get prepared to make that connection. And it was so fascinating to me how that his movement was so similar to watching a running back who's dealing with penetration in the backfield and has to bounce it outside. And what are the ways to go about doing that? And, you know, what seems similar to me was feet in the ground, economy of steps, being able to point that toe where you wanted to go so your hips would open up with it. And then, you know, and then in Garrett's case was, you know, having your shoulder like basically almost pointing to where that target was going to be. And it was just like, you could almost just, you know, it flowed so beautifully, but you could almost, it was one of those instances where you could almost break it down into separate little boxes and see what it was.
No, 100%. And I think, you know, some of the things that are involved in physics or biomechanical principles are relevant in all of our sports. And, you know, you look at a basketball player in the post versus a soccer player who's going to try to make a turn on goal. They both have a defender on their back and they're trying to execute this turn. And so for football coaches, you know, why limit ourselves or think that our position is special if there's a movement skill that's out there that's proven beneficial at the highest levels and we think we can adapt it? I'm all for it. So, yeah, those accuracy, those abilities to turn our shoulders, place our shoulders is a very common theme. We're just, you know, maybe using it for a different outcome here within the tackle. One of the other things that I really like to talk about, and I think you may find interesting, is in our connection series, reshape is a very strong word for me.
Okay.
And it's really important to look at within the tackle. In my development work here at USA Football, especially at the youth and the high school level, I'm a huge proponent of grappling drills just as a means of basic athlete development. I think people, athletes of all stages need to be comfortable in that. So when we're looking at that initial connection, initial collision, one of the ways that we can kind of start to see the impact we had, and it may be through force or it may be through technique, but were we able to reshape the ball carrier? So the position he came into contact, were we able to drastically change his shape?
Yes.
And the common one is if a player lowers himself for contact and I'm going to strike on the rise, you know, that traditional form tackle, I need to be able to change his posture. So I need to go from, you know, spine low and almost horizontal. The more vertical I can raise his spine, I change his center of gravity, and I'm very much able to dominate the contact situation. So I'm looking to change his posture. Now, having respect for my opponents, and as much as we train and as much as we lift weights, we know it's going to happen. Our tacklers are sometimes going to be the ones who lose shape on initial collision.
Right.
You know, I'm getting bent. I'm going to get turned. I'm going to get opened up a little bit. My posture is going to break down. So great tacklers have the ability to dynamically reshape within contact. And after, if they go in, we'll say with great preparation, but on collision, they lose shape. Are they able to dynamically refine positions of power? Can they reset the spine angle? Can they find their hips underneath themselves? Can they keep their cleats in the grass to be able to continue to fight and finish the play? So you look at some huge hits where we reshape the ball carrier, and maybe we don't do a good job with our clamp and grip, and he's able to stumble off and get away. You know, clamp and grip is obviously hugely important, but sometimes both of us have a stalemate, you know, our body postures, and then we're going to work to one of our grappler finish techniques. And sometimes I'm going to get reshaped, and how quickly I can refine positions of power to get back in the fight is hugely important. And I think it tells a lot about the collision, that individual collision, when you start looking at that postural aspect.
I think that makes total sense, because I come from it from an opposite point of view when I think about running backs taking on linebackers or defensive linemen. Yep. And I think about guys like Jamal Charles, who was never a very powerful guy, but he was so good between the tackles, because one of the things that he did was he prevented the defender from reshaping him. And one of the things, the ways he did that so well, was that he was always trying to be the first to deliver the shot. He was always the one trying to deliver the strike, or he was very good at, you know, what running backs often do isn't so much a stiff arm, but it's a forearm, and having that forearm away from your body so that when the defender goes to strike and wrap, that they're wrapping your forearm and you've created a larger bubble of space so that then you can shed that defender before he can get a full grip on you, because he hasn't wrapped your frame. He ended up wrapping, getting his arms around your arm, and then you can kind of expand that or slip under it, and then the ability to get a hold of you is eliminated. And seeing, you know, so it's interesting to hear it from that opposite point of view of I'm trying to reshape you, and seeing how the back at the same time is trying to resist being reshaped, and having techniques to avoid that.
And I think great backs will give you the change up too, where sometimes they try to meet force with force and try to hold their shape. But sometimes they're kind of be like a boxer. You know, they may not execute the full spin move, but they kind of roll their shoulders, or they kind of turn, you know, through their core a little bit. It's almost like they're dissipating that force. They're letting it glance off, and instead of being hard with the shoulder, they let that shoulder move a little bit, and they take that force and kind of spin it off the edge of the actual collision, so it's not going right through you. And then the next time you're expecting the little weeble, the little wobble, the little turn, and that's when they hit you with the hard parts. And so tacklers and ball carriers are playing this game together about who can hold shape or dissipate force or transmit force on almost each and every collision. And that's part of the fun of it, right? Is the little game within the game.
Exactly. It's fantastic. You know, I mean, I was noticing Sony Michel yesterday against the safety for the Jaguars, where he breaks through a roll through the hole for a 15-yard gain, and watched him, you know, lower his shoulder. One of the things I appreciate first from it was that he was turning his shoulder into the defender, but using his non-ball carrying shoulder, even though his ball carrying shoulder was the closest one. So I appreciated that from a ball security standpoint, because that's something that's troubled his game throughout the years at Georgia, but it was fun to watch that. And it almost seemed like the way that he turned it, even he was able to kind of drive with his legs and drive upward into the man and move him backwards. But at the same time, kind of work away from that contact as well as he got that initial kind of uppercut move.
It's actually funny. I took a screenshot of that video and I forgot to send it to you. But the tackler goes down to one knee before contact. He's trying to get so low that he loses body shape and his ability to have to generate force through his feet, through his lower body, because he's down on one knee. And you can clearly see he takes the brunt of it on that collision. But if you freeze frame it, the moment right before a collision, the tackler goes in and he drops his one knee down in an effort where he's just trying to get so low that he loses his power base.
Awesome. It's funny because I posted that on my site this morning, that actual interaction. So I'm going to add that to the post afterwards and I'll put that on there because that's a great note for that.
Well, that actually brings us right to accelerate.
Good.
And you know, for me, it can be summed up pretty easy, but you know, cleats always in the grass. You know, people talk about athletes leaving their feet on contact. And for us, it's about cleats in the grass at all times. I don't want to speak begrudgingly, but I think if you would go to YouTube and look at whoever your favorite team is and pull up some tackle videos from training camp or for a preseason camp, if it's college or the NFL, in our bag drills, you know, with contact limits, and that's the right thing for sure. When teams aren't using a sled and they're using any sort of pad, players just start to dive through the pad. Mm-hmm. And your initial reaction is the aggression is off the charts. Bags are going flying. It looks really cool. And then you freeze frame it and this guy's Superman through the air. And you go, what happens if he made collision right there? Where is he pulling his force from? He has to be grounded to be able to have force. You know, equal and opposite reactions. Good old Newton tells us we got to have something to push off of. So we need to be able to keep our cleats in the ground, which ties back into our tackle heights, our different strike zones, and making sure our footwork can pair up with that to truly be a dominant tackler. Now, you can still make a lot of tackles by those last gasp efforts, but the dominant tacklers are going to keep their cleats in the ground. They're going to have a great ability to kind of roll over that front foot so they're not getting stuck flat footed. So if you know, on my sheet here, I'll see cleats in the grass, always generating controlled power, because we have to be in control. It's a collision aspect, but we have to grapple them and control them and take them to the ground. The ability to roll over that front foot on contact, not get stuck in that kind of coiled up prepared posture, but be able to open up those hips, open up those knees, and generate force out of it. And then if we're going to work that knockback tackle, even over, or if we're taking somebody over to the side, you better be able to roll over that front foot and then generate the force needed to overcome the collision and continue to take steps, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I mentioned earlier that I got to be good friends with Coach Seto. And they made the term drive for five very common. I jokingly always ask our coaches, well, what happens if they don't go down on the fifth step? sometimes we got to run until the job is done. And so we're going to get those feet in the ground, acceleration feet, dominate all the way to the deck, unless it's an NFL quarterback. It's, you know, not trying to be funny, but we have to play within the rules. Right. And so we're able to work through that. And then on the roll tackles, which are becoming very common, not just by teaching, but you know, you have to train what actually happens, not what you want to happen. And if we're giving respect to blockers, which means we're going to be late to the party sometimes, if we're giving respect to the carriers, we're going to be in situations where a drive finish with pure acceleration feet isn't always going to work. So when we look at the roll finish, you know, for me, it's we're trading, you know, acceleration force for circular speed. We're going to try to complete the tackle through torque. So after we make contact, I still want my cleats in the ground because I need to be able to deliver enough power that I stun or stop the ball carrier's progress. But then I'm going to transition into angular speed, good torque of the body, super strong clamp and grip because I can't roll myself off of the runner. I have to bring him with me. And then I trade, like I said, acceleration for torque to generate enough force to take a ball carrier over and ultimately to the deck. So those are just some of the things that, you know, we look at: the ability to accelerate post-contact, cleats always in the ground. You watch a guy roll over the front foot, you'll normally see he's on a good place towards acceleration. Or is this player trading acceleration for torque because of the tackle type he's making? But anytime our cleats aren't in the ground, I'm not happy. And that includes even when the ball carrier's on the ground. We should never be laces down. Always curl your toes. Always be cleats in the ground. Always be ready to work until the job is done.
Nice. So after that, I'm assuming we're at the finishing phase. Is that correct?
Yeah. And so we're going to finish, and, you know, we're going to, you know, sometimes we're going to have to reshape and regrip just as part of that process happens. Guys don't always fall down on their own. But, you know, the two major finishes that everyone's always talked about is going to be, you know, the drive finish where we're going to knock them back, and then the roll finish, you know, which is becoming increasingly popular. But, you know, even on a drive finish, they don't always just fall down. Like, it takes quite a bit to drive somebody all the way over. So we start talking about our grapple finish, which is going to be our upper body within the tackle and how we're trying to, again, continue to change body positions. So if a player is going over to one side, you know, I'm going to try to squeeze down with that arm. I'm going to try to condense his body. And if I can condense his body on one side, I start to dissipate the force and I'm able to more easily take him over that direction. So if I feel his left shoulder down and in, I'm going to double book that. And I'm going to pull that left shoulder down and in, try to make him as small as possible. And if he has an expanded right side and a condensed left side, it's going to be quite easy for me to take him over. So we get into these grapple finishes, sometimes on a stalemate where I'm trying to reestablish my hips. So we would call it hipping in, and it may look like something you'd see from a Greco-Roman wrestler, but two players went in shoulder to shoulder. They both kept their feet in the ground. Now we have this stalemate. Well, now we're trying to either re-accelerate our footwork, or I may have to re-drop my hips because the hip height battle is actually where leverage is won. Leverage is not won by who has the lower shoulder pads. It's who has the lower hips. So I may have to re-sync my hips, get under his hips, then use that secondary lift to be able to change his posture and then be able to move him in whichever direction we're going to take him down. We have our hook and handle finish, which some people call the fish hook finish, but we're going to pick the knee. So it may, especially if a running back is trying to give us same foot, same shoulder. So all I really have is knee, hip, elbow and shoulder pad. He's giving me that real tough surface. When I collide in, if he's going to present that near leg to me, I may just take that near leg. So I may hook the knee right behind his near side knee, the one that he has out towards me as he looks to lean into contact. And I'm going to use that as my hook to be able to get him off his center of gravity and then be able to take him over to the side or backwards. Again, obviously within our rules, this isn't a WWF move. We're just trying to change his posture and be able to take him over, not actually like lift him up and body slam him and get a penalty. But we have to have these displacement techniques to change his center of gravity. I think the key to any tackle really becomes manipulating your opponent's center of gravity. On a low level tackle, you can think about it that if I strike your thighs boards with enough force on a drive finish, I'm just removing the base from underneath the center of gravity, and then you're coming down. On the form tackle, when I stand your posture upright, I'm changing your center of gravity so that I can control the situation. On our grapple finish or our hook and handle finish, I'm looking to offset your center of gravity by condensing one side or lifting one side. And then within our rehip, I'm trying to, again, get underneath and then lift your center of gravity off of the stalemate to be able to dominate it. Now, it probably sounds crazy on a podcast, but I promise we practice it. We drill it. We have, very distinct drills that we work with in this. We start with basic grappling drills, and then we build into collision and tackle drills where we're giving guys, as we say, a tool for every situation.
Nice. No, this is fantastic. And before I let you go, I would love for you whether you want to describe, whether you can think of them in terms of each of those phases that you've spent this podcast describing, or just as a whole, I would love for you to recommend to people defenders that you've watched at any, whether it's the college level or the pro level, that you think are particularly good tacklers and or are particularly strong at specific phases of tackling.
Yeah, generally speaking, I think if you look at our special teams guys, you'll start to see some of your best tracking as far as spatial tracking goes. Michael Thomas with the Giants, formerly of the Dolphins, I believe was an All-Pro last year. But those great natural cover skill guys. It's going to sound like a homer pick because he and I share a rugby background, but obviously Nate Ebner's done very well for himself with the Patriots. Then you start to get the small space tracking guys, which are going to be kind of our in the cylinder people. And I really think these guys are, obviously you have to have the footwork to match what you're seeing, but you start to see the mental processing of being able to weave in and out of traffic and find ball players in traffic, which is a different, unique tracking standpoint. And Sean Lee is probably, as good at that as anybody. It's no surprise. I mean, I think a lot of people obviously appreciate him and like his work, but his in the cylinder ability to find stuff and track in and around all these big bodies, I think is absolutely fantastic. Within the preparation phase, you'll see some of the guys from like Earl Thomas, and will come, has always done a great job with his foot placement and being in the right spot. Some of the bigger lineman guys, really only have two options. They're gonna form tackle you and swallow you up, or if you're running away from them, it's going to turn into kind of a roll tackle just because they're not fast enough to close the distance. Yeah. So some of those interior guys actually do a really great natural job of initiating the right strike or the right tackle to the right situation because of what we could say are perceived speed differences, especially the interior guys who, or they're going to smack it in the mouth or they're going to have to chase it down. You'll see some great stuff from some of the interior guys as well. On connection, it's about kind of, again, the shoulder contact accuracy and then the ability to reshape and dominate. Again, I'm partial to Sean Lee's work. I think he re-grips and reclamps and reshapes and kind of climbs in and fights in on some tackles really well. I love some of his work. And then there's quite a few rugby guys that I would give a shout out to on that aspect, guys that just have really dominant clamps and grappling. I found it's trained a lot more because it's a part of other aspects of the game. And I think it carries over into their tackling really well. So it's not just about that. And one interesting take, sorry, on a rabbit hole, but
no, please.
I think people who are interested in the rugby to football tackle comparison, a lot of what we talked about is the path in the blockers, and in rugby, blocking is obviously illegal. In fact, some people don't know this. Screening is actually illegal. So unlike even basketball or lacrosse, you can't set a screen. By rule, every player on the defense has rights to the ball carrier. to be able to take that line and that path of the ball carrier. So when we start to make some of those transitions into football, I think the blockers and the angles and the pass to the ball carrier is the biggest thing that needs to be reconciled. There are some absolutely great technical items within the collision to be learned, but I also think within the tracking aspect, we have to make sure we're respecting both games enough. But because of that, I think some of the connection work and some of the grappling work, those guys do an absolutely great job of that. When it comes to accelerate, I've seen some absolutely great clips from Devin Bush for Michigan Wolverines, and that kills me. I'm a Penn State guy to say, but I have a couple clips of him where on initial contact, he's actually been reshaped and went to a knee, but scrambled back to his feet and was able to finish the tackle. So those guys are doing a really great job with driving their feet. But anytime you see a guy, I tell people, if they're on the ground and their toes are still curled and they still have that toe cleat in the ground, then they were working to drive through and finish and not just kind of dive in that last little bit and kind of landing on top. And then when it comes to the different finishes, I think you'll see some of our roll tackle secondary guys. You know, the Seahawks have been a proponent of it for probably the longest, and now some of those guys have moved on, so they may have the most experience with it. But the ability to convert, a single leg grip into a complete roll tackle and actually finish the job in what may be considered a non-textbook scenario jumps out to me as some of the best work. Getting in and out of stalemates or not being in the ideal situation, staying strong to the KPIs, solid clamp, solid grip, and then, you know, trading speed for torque and being able to get a guy down in a non teach film scenario traditionally, but it's probably the teach film of today.
Huh. Very, very, very good stuff. So before I let you go, I have to ask you one more question. And that is, you know, you were an All-American rugby player and you played at Penn State. So what if you were to evaluate yourself as a tackler, how would you evaluate yourself?
Oh, goodness. I was average at best, I've learned a lot in my studies since then. My father was a rugby coach. Okay. And so I grew up in the backyard learning to tackle cheek to cheek, you know, through the thighs. And I can probably tell you that my collegiate coaching staff wasn't always thrilled with that technique. We are much more, you know, front them up, knock them back in all situations. And I was used, you know, a variety of different tackles in different situations. And so they weren't always thrilled, and it served me served me pretty well. I was, I like to think that I was a smart player and I was good at diagnosing things. I was limited in speed. So I tell people that I made a lot of roll tackles because, I was being out leveraged and that was about the only option I had. So, but they say those who can't do teach, and, it sent me on this quest. So, I have seven career starts at Penn State. So this is by no means me. You know, I was not the best player. I was good enough to play. I was good enough to be a backup, and somebody got injured and I got a few starts and they got healthy and I went back to the bench. But it exposed me to some great coaches, obviously, and it exposed me to this whole field, sent me down this path. So I'm thrilled. But I would say I was average at best, and all of the learning and studying has since paid off.
Well, your contributions have been awesome, and they've certainly been great for this podcast. And I appreciate the generosity of your time to really go through all of the facets of tackling. This has been so educational for me, and it makes me want to dive into more of your work. You can find, Andy at USA Football MT. That's his Twitter handle. You can also find him at usafootball.com. And he does some blogging there as well. He just came out with a blog post that I retweeted this morning, you know, that is a really good breakdown separating fundamentals, techniques, and skills. And we touched on a lot of that conversation today, but you can find definitely a lot more there. Andy, thanks a lot for joining me today.
It's an absolute pleasure to be on. I really appreciate the invite. And like you said, I'm a sucker for talking tackling, but to get to be on the podcast and is truly an honor, because I'm just a knucklehead who likes to coach some tackle football every now and then.
Well, from one knucklehead to another, you know, this has been great. And for all you knuckleheads out there who have been listening, I appreciate what you've been doing in terms of giving the feedback to the RSP cast. Please rate and review it if you have an opportunity to. We definitely would like to know what you think and what you'd like to hear. And, you know, you can definitely check out more of my work at mattwaldmanrsp.com. I'm about 75 players in for the 2019 Rookie Scouting Portfolio publication. I'll be focusing more on some of those things down the line. And if you're new to the RSP, you know, please check out mattwaldmanrsp.com for more information. I donate 10% of each sale to the publication each year to Darkness to Light, which is an organization devoted to preventing and appropriately addressing sexual abuse of children, so that can, you know, that our communities can be more aware and build stronger foundations. So thanks again, Andy, and thanks for everyone for your time for listening, and we will see you next week.